Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our guests today, both from the University of Northern Iowa, both professors of political science there, Donna Hoffman, welcome to you.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon, and good afternoon to your colleague, Chris Larimer. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Ben.
A little bit later in the hour, a little preview, changing attitudes about climate change, whether they're changing the political view as well, also changing attitudes about COVID vaccinations. President Biden's dip in the polls, that new abortion law in Texas, for sure we want to talk about that, and whether states like Iowa will try to follow suit, modeling legislation after that. Also, toward the end of the hour, reflections on how the attack on 9/11 20 years ago changed our political landscape. If you'd like to join our conversation this hour, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. First of all, though, let's talk about what we heard in the NPR news at the top of the hour this week. Democrats began officially drafting this ambitious social policy plan, this budget reconciliation bill. It's been called the most significant expansion of the nation's safety net since the war on poverty in the 1960s. Price tag right now, $3.5 trillion, aimed at slowing climate change, expanding health care and education, cutting poverty, increasing taxes on the wealthy. But the passage of this bill is anything but certain. Joe Biden will need every single Democrat in the Senate to vote yes on this, and virtually everyone in the House to secure it. Donna, first of all, a little bit about the process here. House Democrats insisting that the two chambers negotiate up front over what bill they can each pass, and only after they have reached that deal with the White with the House, then vote on it. Talk a little bit about the process, how the two houses, narrowly controlled by the Democrats, are working on this bill.
Well, actually, I can make your eyes glaze over with some detail on the process. I did that with my class the other day. It wasn't all that successful. But I will tell you this. This is extraordinarily complicated because of the dynamics of how the House works, but also the small margins that Democrats have. So, you know, in pointing out the cost of this bill, you mentioned $3.5 trillion. One clarification to put on that is that's over 10 years. So I actually saw someone break down the cost of this bill for citizens of the United States is $1,000 every year. Okay. But what that would go to pay for is, as you mentioned, a whole passel of things. Now, there's two bills here. Essentially, there's the infrastructure bill, which has essentially gone through regular process. And the House has tied that to, it passed the House first, it went to the Senate, they amended it, it's back to the House. Nancy Pelosi in the House has tied that to the larger reconciliation bill. Now, that infrastructure bill in the Senate in particular garnered 19 Republican votes. It's popular. Democrats like it. Lots of Republicans like it. It's dealing with what we might think of as the hard infrastructure, the bridges, the roads, the dams, those kinds of things. The what we might think of as a little bit more softer infrastructure, the healthcare, the education, the climate that you mentioned, was put in this reconciliation package. And it in particular was put into the reconciliation package because you can pass that in the Senate without it being subject to a filibuster. And so as you mentioned, the Democrats could pass that provided they all hang together with their 50 Democrats and then Vice President Kamala Harris breaking the tie there. But they have to all hang together. And so one of the wrinkles in this bill, first of all, as you mentioned, they're still cobbling together what is going to be in this. It's working its way through the committee process in both the House and the Senate. There's an agreement to do some pre-conferencing on this, which will save them time in the end. Because the rule that they passed a few weeks ago set a target date to pass the infrastructure bill for September 27th. And so they're trying to move this very quickly. We don't exactly know what the details are going to be. We do know, though, earlier in the week, Senator Manchin said he thought there ought to be a pause, that $3.5 trillion over 10 years is too much. when the rubber hits the road, you know, it may be that there's a negotiation that gets him on board. Same is true with Senator Kyrsten Sinema. She's kind of in the same camp. She hasn't been quite as vocal as Manchin has been. So the key there is that the Democrats in the Senate have to hang together. And so if you're one of those people on the fence, your Sinema, your Manchin, you have some leverage potentially to get what you want out of this. And, you know, we know throughout history, individual senators, individual members of the House sometimes get something in a bill like this that gets them on board, that might benefit their state, that might benefit their district. And there, I should add here that there's nothing unusual about that. That is, in fact, part of the legislative process. The old saw goes, there's two things you don't want to see being made, sausage and legislation. Right. And so it is very complicated, but that's kind of where we stand.
We like to, in any issue, we talk, like to talk about how where Iowa's congressional delegation stands. It's easy to figure that out in this case, because it is, as reflected nationwide, very party line on this $3.5 trillion social policy reconciliation bill, the five Republicans in Iowa against it, the one Democrat, Cindy Axne, for it, all voting along party lines, as I mentioned. Chris, what do you see here as possible sticking points, the chances the Democrats have of making good on this promise?
Well, I think Donna outlined it pretty well that, you know, this is a very political issue. We have not seen any deviations from party line votes on really anything since the Biden administration took over in January. And so I think, you know, without knowing all the details, there's still quite a bit of uncertainty up there or in the air with both the infrastructure package and this $3.5 trillion package. I think going forward, trying to think about how this would play out, There was an interesting book published a few years ago called Good Enough for Government Work by a political scientist, Amy Lehrman. And in it, she goes through and talks about, you know, for a lot of people, we know that, you know, trust in government has been declining. People are generally are increasingly more skeptical of government doing things. But what she finds is that when people actually have experience with government service and can credit government for that, for a positive experience in terms of receiving benefits, their perception improves. And so if we think about what's in this $3.5 trillion package, there was an article in the New York Times recently talking about the package itself, the title of the article being from the cradle to the grave, about the amount of benefits over time that would go to individuals in terms of, you know, universal pre-K, childcare support, 2 years of post-secondary education and so forth. So, you know, if that package goes through, if somehow the Democrats are able to get that through and those benefits start to take hold and go out to individuals over a period of time, it would be interesting to see how this benefits the Democratic Party going forward. I think right now the big sticking point, as Donna pointed out, is simply the price tag. You have bipartisan support for an infrastructure bill that's $1 trillion, but then you have a $3.5 trillion package, and all that everybody is talking about is the price tag, both Democrats and Republicans. So I think right now it's an incredibly political issue. The other part of that complicates everything is that we're coming up on the end of the fiscal year. We're coming up on potentially a vote on the debt ceiling. And so there's going to be a lot of politics surrounding both of those issues. On top of that, the Biden administration has said that they want to put in place a stopgap funding bill to give them a little bit of time past the end of the fiscal year on September 30th. And in that bill, they want to include aid for states affected by Hurricane Ida, aid for refugee resettlement for refugees from Afghanistan. And so all this is becoming very political, which makes it difficult to see how this is going to play out other than it would be a party line vote.
Mm-hmm. We'll find that out in the coming weeks, perhaps by the end of September, the fate of this reconciliation bill. I know predictions are a risky business. Chris or Donna, would you like to make any predictions or pass on that? Donna?
Well, I would just say that, you know, there's pretty broad support for the infrastructure bill. And where the sticking point is here is that, you know, if we just had a vote on the infrastructure bill, the hard infrastructure bill, as we were talking about, the House would pass it, it would be done, it would go to Biden's desk, he would sign it. But the leverage that is within that bill is what we're looking at here with the reconciliation, a separate bill. Some of the progressives in the House are saying, look, we'll withhold our vote from that infrastructure bill that, you know, if we vote for it, will pass. until you get us this reconciliation bill and until we, you know, kind of tie them, metaphorically speaking, together to ensure the passage of that. And so the longer this takes, the less likely that that infrastructure bill passes. Now, having said that, I do think that at the end of the next couple of months, that infrastructure bill will pass. The reconciliation bill, I think, is a little bit more difficult.
Yeah.
But I do think we will see something. There's been too much expended here, too much to go into it. Lots of agreement on some of the aspects of this, and I think that that parts of it will come to fruition.
That would be something, though, wouldn't it, Chris? If the infrastructure, what we're calling the hard infrastructure bill, failed at the feet of progressive Democrats, wouldn't it? Can you imagine that happening?
I think, you know, potentially, but I think Democrats are also looking ahead to 2022, that they need something positive to run on, right? They need that signature piece of legislation for the 2022 midterm elections. We already know that that Republicans are going to, at least right now, it looks they're obviously going to be talking a lot about the ending of the war in Afghanistan and how that unfolded throughout August. So if Democrats at the end of the day can come together and push that infrastructure package through, you would expect that to be kind of one of these signature policy achievements that they're talking about going into the 2022 election. If it would fail, I think it would speak volumes to the way that politics unfolds at the national level, in terms of we have had several administrations, and we've talked about this on the show before, several administrations wanting to do something on infrastructure. If this falls or fails because of not just inter-party fighting, but intra-party fighting, I think it would further erode Americans' confidence in governmental institutions to get anything done.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, his colleague Donna Hoffman, both professors of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Well, climate change poses an existential threat to our lives, our economy. President Biden, after surveying storm damage in New York and New Jersey, an editorial from more than 200 scientific journals called rising temperatures in the world the greatest public threat. Today, we are hearing the Biden administration announcing plans to produce almost half of the nation's electricity from the sun by 2050 in an effort to combat climate change. Yesterday, at a press conference in New Orleans, President Biden spoke about the threat of climate change following Hurricane Ida and how he has been seeing these types of extreme weather events all across the country. Let's listen.
For decades, scientists have warned of extreme weather would be more extreme, and climate change was here, and we're living through it now. We don't have any more time. I hope no one, I've been on the telephone or on the road an awful lot between California, Idaho, New Orleans, Louisiana, but in New Orleans, Mississippi, and, here. I mean, every part of the country is getting hit by extreme weather. And we're now living in real time what the country's going to look like. And if we don't do something, we can't turn it back very much, but we can prevent it from getting worse.
President Biden yesterday in New Orleans surveying the damage there. Chris, let me start with you this time. Where are we with the political will to act to stem climate change in a meaningful way?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we talk about this a lot in a public policy class I teach in the fall, where trying to get a sense of when you see events happening, or when significant studies come out, what does that mean for the likelihood of policy change? As President Biden said, there's been decades of research on climate change showing the effects, and we've seen studies coming out showing significant effects, right? It was just a few years ago, a study coming out talking about, 3 billion birds that have disappeared since 1970. Other, massive studies from the UN coming out on climate change, talking about the horrible potential effects of climate change. And now we see events like this. I think, and I want to be careful here, because I don't have any polling data to support this, but you get the sense that for a lot of people, their opinions on climate change and the urgency the urgency to address climate change, their opinions on that are somewhat settled, because we've seen horrible events. We've seen, you know, an increase in these weather-related events, but we it's hard to get policy movement at the federal level on climate change, right? We part of the infrastructure bill was scaled back. Some of the provisions relating to climate change and promotion of green energy were pulled. We've seen other green energy plans scaled back or not even make it through a single chamber in Congress. And so, even though we have these significant events, we're not necessarily seeing the policy movement that we might expect because everything is getting bogged down in partisan politics.
Donna, do you see it the same way?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, one of the things to think about here is while I think there's been some movement on public opinion in terms of, you know, that we see the climate changing, there is dispute over whether that's human caused or not. There's dispute over, you know, whether we can do anything to slow it down, as the president said in his remarks. And, you know, and then there's also, so there's kind of the big amorphous concerns here that there's some disagreement on in terms of cause and effect. But, you know, when you look at localized aspects within states, you have oil producing states where a significant number of people may be, you know, getting their livelihood from the extraction of energy from the ground. You have Iowa, where as we don't have a lot of oil wells here, we do have, you know, the ethanol industry. And so this can be a concern. And you can get that coalition of minorities building up that can really stymie any kind of far-reaching broad change. And that's kind of the policy dilemma that we find ourselves in. However, you know, when you have the West Coast on fire, the Gulf Coast having more severe hurricanes, the East Coast, you know, having real infrastructure problems in terms of water pouring into subways and that kind of thing. These things could, you know, come together in a stream that could, you know, eventually get some movement here. But, you know, it's a hard slog, as we've seen. And I should note here also that, you know, this did not used to be so partisanly divided as well. But like many other things that we see in this country in the last 20 years, at some point, this issue did start to take on a partisan divide here as well. And, you know, those are really intractable problems at this moment that, you know, really take a lot of effort and leadership in particular. And, you know, this is an issue that I really think you're going to have elite leadership on. But, you know, we'll see what else the environment has in store for us in the next several years.
A demonstration of how partisan this issue has become. Just a few days ago, in interviewing a number of Iowa farmers on this and other topics, but in this one in particular, one said when talking about how farmers talk to each other here in Iowa, he said farmers do recognize the climate is changing for sure and do recognize for the most part that humans are causing that. But interestingly, Chris and Donna, he said that climate change, that phrase, is avoided as a term. Too much political baggage, I guess. So he said if you talk about farmers one to another saying, oh, the weather's changing over time, just don't use the word climate change. I thought that was interesting. You think so, Chris?
I do. And we see that with other policies where, you know, if they get talked about under a general umbrella, people just split immediately along predicted partisan lines. But you take something like gun control, where it's, you know, there is a very clear partisan divide if you're talking about gun control legislation. But then we've seen in poll after poll, if you start to pull out specific provisions related to gun control, such as background checks or restrictions on guns for individuals with mental health issues, there's widespread support, at least in polling, for those, up 80-90%. But if we start just talking, if the debate just becomes framed around gun control generally, then everybody splits along partisan lines. So it's not surprising to me that you're seeing the same thing with climate change.
And Ben, I would add here that, you know, we use the term climate change largely now because the previous term, global warming, also became politically charged. And so language matters here. And, you know, when we talk about the abortion debate, language, we see language mattering there as well. You know, what really citizens need to do is think about the nuance of the way we talk about things and the ways in which sometimes more nuance can also engender more agreement on some of these things, like you see with farmers potentially, you know, talking about the weather changing. It's not climate change, but the weather is changing. Well, then if the weather is changing, what potentially, you know, could we do about that? And that takes a lot of work. And again, it takes that nuance both from policymakers, but also from citizens in terms of what they expect and what they want out of their government.
Before we go to break in a couple minutes, let's see if we can squeeze in your remarks on a new Washington Post ABC News poll. In summary, the Delta variant's 2-month surge has generated a rise in public fears about contracting the virus, undermined confidence in Biden's leadership, renewed some divisions over vaccine and mask mandates, Biden's overall approval rating falling from 50 to 44%. It was back in June, 50%, also dragged down by a 2-to-1 disapproval for his handling of Afghanistan following that chaotic withdrawal. Biden's handling of the economy, his ratings there also declining, 52% positive in April, 45% in the latest survey. About a minute for each of you to react to this. Donna, will you go first this time?
Sure. I would just say there's, you know, a couple of things to point out about this. You know, one, the Afghanistan issue, while it's dominant right now, Americans, by and large, don't pay that much attention to foreign policy. And we also have polling that shows that, you know, a large majority of them wanted out of Afghanistan. That will fade in terms of its effect on Biden's overall approval rating. But I would pull one thing out of that poll is that 52%, so that's a majority, still approve of Biden's handling of the virus. Now, that's fallen in recent weeks, mm-hmm. but he's still getting, you know, largely pretty good marks on that. And especially with the resurgence or the surgence of the Delta variant, you know, that's still actually not too bad a territory for him to be in. And with the Afghanistan stuff, as I mentioned, I think those effects will go away pretty quickly.
Yep. 62% in late June approval rating for Biden handling the pandemic dropping to, according to this poll, 52%. Quickly from you, Chris, we have just under a minute.
Yeah, I think Donna's right. That 52% is important because I do think it suggests that Biden has a little bit of leeway here with the pandemic because his administration has been so active in trying to address the pandemic in terms of vaccines and mask wearing and so forth. I think the other thing the poll reflects is just generally what happens to chief executives when their party has unified control. That typically people look to the chief executive and either give credit or give blame. That can be at the state level or at the federal level. But if you are the chief executive, when your party has complete control of government, the public's going to direct their blame toward you.
All right. We'll be back in just a few minutes after a short break with Chris Larimer and Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, our political analysts, professors of politics at the University of Northern Iowa. When we come back, we'll talk about the ripples from that U.S. Supreme Court action late last week on abortion, the U.S. Supreme Court allowing a Texas abortion law to take effect last week. The ban is the most restrictive abortion law to be enforced since the Supreme Court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision legalized abortion nationwide. We'll talk about it and ask the question, will Iowa and other states led by Republicans look to the Texas law for a model to restrict access to abortion? We'll talk about it when we get back in just a moment.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the Extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's your Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with our political scientists Chris Larimer and Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, both professors in the Department of Political Science there. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about the ripples from the Supreme Court action last week on abortion, the High Court allowing a Texas abortion law to take effect. The ban is the most restrictive abortion law to be enforced since the Supreme Court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision legalized abortion nationwide. This Texas law bans all abortions, including in cases of rape and incest, after the detection of cardiac activity. which is usually around 6 weeks, and that's before many people know they are pregnant. Also, a part of this law, key, it allows individuals to sue anyone suspected of helping a woman obtain an abortion and awards at least $10,000 to people who do so successfully. Now, the U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland on Monday in a statement said the Justice Department will, quote, protect those seeking to obtain or provide reproductive health services in Texas as it explores options to challenge the state's abortion law. Let's hear from the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki on this. Last week at a White House press conference, she was questioned by a reporter about the president's stance on abortion and whether or not President Biden's Catholic faith has influenced his position.
He believes that it's a woman's right, it's a woman's body, and it's her choice.
Why does the president, who does he believe then should look out for the unborn child?
He believes that it's up to a woman to make those decisions and up to a woman to make those decisions with her doctor. I know you've never faced those choices, nor have you ever been pregnant, but for women out there who have faced those choices, this is an incredibly difficult thing. The president believes their rights should be respected. Go ahead. I think we got to move on. I think we have to move on. You've had plenty of time today.
Press Secretary Jen Psaki of the White House last week. Donna, what do you see happening here? What does this latest move by the U.S. Supreme Court say about the future of abortion in the U.S.?
Well, so this is a little bit complicated in that what the Supreme Court did was refuse to stop the Texas law from going into effect. They didn't weigh in on the merits of this case. We expected, given what we know about how the Supreme Court traditionally has acted here, that on something like this, while this law would have been being litigated, it would have been there would have been an injunction. It wouldn't have been enforced. That is not what they did. So that was a bit of a surprise. But there is also new personnel on the Supreme Court, as we know. So the Texas case certainly shows then in the state of Texas what potentially is possible. It's a you know, something other states can look at, but states are already doing this. So we know that coming before the Supreme Court this fall, when they begin their new term, they are hearing a case from Mississippi. They're hearing the arguments. And so note on the Texas case, you know, they didn't hear arguments. They just refused to keep it from going into effect. In the Mississippi case, there's a 15-week ban. The justices will actually hear the arguments, read the briefs on this particular issue. It will be decided. You know, we don't expect them to render a decision on that case until the summer, as is typical with their decisions that they hear in the fall. They render a decision. That is the vehicle by which Mississippi and then other people who do not support a woman's right to choose to overturning both Roe, but also Casey, a 92 law that allowed the states to interfere in the first trimester, as long as it didn't pose an undue burden. Now, I would note here, we talked earlier about language. We talked earlier about public opinion on these issues. You know, the Texas bill is called the heartbeat bill. Defenders of a woman's right to choose will call it the six-week bill. You know, and I'm not a physician, neither are many of these people. However, you know, when a woman is 6 weeks pregnant, being the only, I'm going to be like the press secretary was, being the only woman on this show right now who's ever been pregnant, I can tell you that, you know, the way that pregnancy is counted, there could be some time in there in which the woman is not actually pregnant and you have an embryo. It's not even a fetus until about 6 weeks. So the heartbeat bill, as it is called, that language is used to push emotional buttons. A heartbeat detected at 6 weeks isn't actually a heartbeat. It's a pulse. There's not a heart yet. The language here is important. This is why supporters of women's right to choose will call it the 6 week ban. So this is a really, really short. And as I mentioned, the Mississippi bill, 15 weeks is what they have on that. Women typically are not even going to know that they are pregnant in this kind of scenario. You know, what the federal government can do here to try to protect what is a constitutional right, it is still a constitutional right in this country that women have a right to an abortion, at least in the first trimester. And the what the federal government can do here is, you know, a little bit of a gray area. What the Justice Department has said is that they would potentially use what is called the FACE Act, which stands for Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances, to try to help women in Texas still have this right is, you know, a little bit problematic, and that it's probably not necessarily all that effective. The purpose of this bill and the purpose of the movement, especially in southern states where you don't see very many abortion clinics anymore, has been to chip away over the years to make it harder for abortion providers to exist in those states. Mississippi, the case that's coming before the court, has one abortion clinic in the entire state. So something like the FACE Act is not necessarily going to be all that effective in Texas, because if these clinics go out of business, it doesn't apply. And so this is, again, one of those complicated issues in which messaging is important, but we can talk about public opinion too. And actually on this issue, public opinion is pretty consistent over the last 20, 30 years. A Pew poll in May of 2021, so, you know, before some of the recent hubbub actually, you know, hit the news. Certainly things were going on, but it wasn't the headlines. 59% of the public say abortion should be legal in most cases. And that view has not changed much in recent years. Only 39% of the public think that it should be illegal in most cases. So there also then becomes, from a political angle, the question of whether in Texas, in other states, there is an overreach here, and whether voters are paying attention to this issue, whether voters will take this into account the next time they go into a polling booth. And we don't really have good data on that. But the potential is there if we look at public opinion. And it has long been something that some commentators in this area have talked about, is that this has always been an effective issue for getting people emotional, for getting them to turn out. If the issue is no longer there, i.e., you know, Roe has been overturned, you know, later, then the emotional intensity is on the other side of this question. So this is really, you know, kind of a can of worms.
Chris, can you zero in a little bit more on what this might mean for Iowa? A little background there. In June of last year, Governor Reynolds signed that law, a bill into law requiring a 24-hour waiting period before a woman can get an abortion. Planned Parenthood of the Heartland sued that. A judge struck the law down this June, citing a 2018 ruling that declared abortion a fundamental right under the state constitution. How do you see this latest Texas ruling and the action of the U.S. Supreme Court in what happens here in Iowa?
Well, I think you're right. You know, talking about those bills, I mean, what we've seen in Iowa since Republicans obtained unified control of state government following the 2016 elections is that there has been a lot of activity on the issue of abortion. You mentioned the 2018 ruling, which struck down a 72-hour waiting period that the Republican-controlled legislature had passed and was signed into law. There was, and respecting what Donna just said, a what was labeled at the time as a fetal heartbeat bill, but really a six-week bill that was passed through the Iowa legislature but was ruled unconstitutional in 2019. You mentioned the 24-hour waiting period bill that was passed in 2020 but ultimately ruled unconstitutional in 2021. And then in the 2021 legislative session, the Iowa legislature approved a constitutional amendment to add to the Iowa Constitution that to declare that the Iowa in the Constitution does not recognize, grant, or secure a right to abortion. And so that amendment still has to go through the amendment process, which takes a couple of years. The point is that there's been a lot of activity in Iowa on attempts by the Republican-controlled legislature to try to restrict abortion in Iowa. So if this Texas law continues to stand, I don't think there's any reason not to expect that the Iowa legislature in 2022 is going to continue to push for abortion restrictions, right? We've seen the legislature do it in the past, and we've seen Governor Reynolds sign into law. I think with what's going to be interesting here is the timing, to get at Donna's point about public opinion. If you think back to the same-sex marriage ruling in Iowa, the Barnum v. Bryan ruling, and then there was backlash to that leading up to the 2010 elections, but shortly after that, opinion in Iowa started to change on same-sex marriage. The way the constitutional amendment process works in Iowa is that it has to pass two general assemblies and then it would go before voters. So it passed in the 2021 session, but there's going to be the intervening elections in 2022, and then it would have to pass in 2023 or 2024 before it would go to voters in Iowa, before this amendment would be approved to constitutionally amend the Iowa state constitution. And so it will be interesting to see how opinions potentially change over that period of time. But I think to your immediate question, I don't think there's any reason not to expect action on abortion in Iowa, given the track record that Republicans have had over the last 3 to 4 years on this issue.
Mm-hmm. What about this wrinkle, Donna, you first on this, that allows individuals, really figuratively deputizes people to sue anyone suspected of helping a woman obtain an abortion and awarding at least $10,000 to people who do so successfully? This is a wrinkle we haven't seen before and interesting. I mean, you just think it's so different than what we've ever experienced in a law, isn't it?
It is a little different. And as I understand it, and, you know, again, I'm not a lawyer. Litigation is not my area of expertise. But as I understand that provision in the Texas law, that was in part to help prevent litigation from moving forward quickly, because the people who are enforcing this law are essentially everyday citizens that you're, you know, kind of deputizing. We could also talk about the vigilantism that could be rampant here. And so you're not suing the law enforcement officers in the state of Texas, which normally you would do. So I think that is part of a legislative strategy. But it is also one of the more controversial. I mean, this Texas law is a passel of controversial aspects, but that in particular, because it is relatively unheard of, was one of the reasons why the Supreme Court's actions in not staying this were, I think, a little bit surprising to many people, in that opens up, you know, a whole host of potential nefariousness with, you know, people trying to get revenge. This not being overseen by elected officials or people who know the law. And so, you know, I don't think the Texas case is going to go away. I mean, we're going to see litigation continue on this, but it is going to be drawn out and extended. And in particular, that aspect of it, you know, societally has, you know, again, that potential for blowback where you have, you know, family members who may disagree with someone, or, you know, spurned lovers, or just troublemakers seeking a monetary reward, we should add here, you know, for telling on citizens' private actions.
Mm-hmm. A couple of other things before our hour ends in this Politics Wednesday with Donna Hoffman and Chris Larimer. Quickly, let's talk about the former president, his plans to hold a rally at the Iowa State Fairgrounds October 9th. This is according to the Des Moines Register, citing a source familiar with his plans. Trump has left the door open to another campaign, not officially announced. There are a host of possible presidential contenders in the Republican column. Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio have already begun visiting Iowa to hold fundraisers for local candidates, attend party dinners. We remind ourselves Trump handily won Iowa in 2016, also 2020, carrying the state by over 9 percentage points in 2016, 8 percentage points in 2020. Chris, sure looks like Trump is laying the groundwork, putting boots on the ground here in Iowa, doesn't it?
Well, it looks like he's doing something. I think it's hard to get a good read of where this is going to go. I mean, I know we always talk about how every presidential election cycle starts the day after the previous election. But I think with Donald Trump in this case, I think there's still quite a bit of time in terms to trying to figure out where this is going. Is he doing this just to, you know, kind of be back in the news, to try to just get his name, be among supporters? I think it's still a little bit difficult to read in this case where he's going with this, but he's certainly taking the steps that you would expect a potential candidate to take in terms of not only fundraising, not only having, you know, continuing with the press releases that his office is putting out, but obviously visiting Iowa. It'll be interesting to see if he chooses to visit other states in the coming months, but at least visiting Iowa suggests that he's potentially thinking about it, or his staffers are thinking about 2024.
Donna, a quick word on Donald Trump again in 2024, possibly?
Yeah, he has, you know, everything to lose by coming out right now and saying, I'm not running, because he won't be able to fundraise. He'll fade from the public picture. You know, one of the things we know about Donald Trump is he likes to be in the center of things. He likes to be in the spotlight. And so even if he doesn't end up running, or even if right now he's not even thinking about running, I fully expect that he's going to talk about it like he is and act like he is, because he's a different kind of politician in this sense. He's used creative fundraising. He's, you know, pressuring people into you know, hard sells kind of on the fundraising, some automatic renewals of those fundraising things we've seen some issues on. And, you know, if Donald Trump tomorrow says, yeah, never mind, I'm not going to run for president, then the movement shifts from him. And he doesn't want that to happen. So I have every expectation that he'll take this as far out as he possibly can within the confines of the party, because as you mentioned, there are other people waiting in the Republican wings and even setting the groundwork with at least some expectation that he won't in fact run.
Yeah, essentially freezing that alternative slate of competitors, perhaps. Let's spend the last 3-4 minutes on the anniversary coming up this Saturday, the 20th anniversary of the attacks on 9/11. So crystallized in our memories that very day. Some reflection now, 20 years on. Your thoughts, Chris, start us off on how 9/11 has changed our politics. It's so dramatic. I mean, it's changed every aspect of our lives. What do you want to zero in as we reflect on this anniversary?
Well, I think that's exactly right. It's changed every aspect of our lives, and it's changed every aspect of the political atmosphere, right? It's changed our governmental institutions. It enlarged our bureaucracy on a scale that we really hadn't seen for decades in terms of the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, the consolidation of agencies under that, the expansion of resources. And it fundamentally changed governmental institutions, and it fundamentally changed public opinion, you know, in the immediate aftermath and really for 5-10 years and even up till now. Policies are thought about initially in terms of national security, rather than perhaps basic economics. And so, it has permanently, or at least fundamentally, changed the American psyche in terms of how we think about several public policies or across policy arenas, right? That everything starts with national security, I think, still for a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you look at public opinion, if you look at governmental institutions, it has changed things.
Yeah. And also this 20th anniversary coinciding with our exit from the 20-year war, Afghanistan. Donna, your thoughts?
I would point out that, you know, the students that Chris and I have in class right now at the University of Northern Iowa don't remember 9/11.
Oh, my goodness.
They were kids. They were infants. You know, and so, yeah, that makes us feel a little old. But there is a potential for this to fade. And I think with the exit from Afghanistan, there is some of that. But two things that I think are really striking here in terms of how the American public kind of adjusted to this new environment. One is that I think Americans have become much more accepting of surveillance in their lives. And we can see this in social media, even their use of social media, which, you know, we weren't doing in 2001 for the most part. I'm not sure Facebook existed yet. I'm pretty sure they didn't. We're accepting of the public aspect of our lives and the surveillance that can take place in the public square. That in 2001 was a little bit controversial. I can think of, you know, the Patriot Act passing in the immediate aftermath, for example, that, you know, there were some offshoots of that later on that people had difficulty with. The other thing that I would point out here is the militarization of local police forces. We were so scared that we didn't know where terrorism was coming. It was going to hit your local town. Congress beefed up and states beefed up resources available to police, and in particular, the kind of equipment that typically went to the military. This is from the feds, that would flow down into cities, even smaller cities, in this regard, that has had an effect on how we view the police, how the police view what their job is. And those are things that I think continue to have pretty lasting effects.
Mm-hmm. Could each of you give us a snapshot of your memory of that day? Very briefly, Chris, we all have images of our own experience. Where were you when you found out and saw the towers fall?
Yeah, so I was in graduate school at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, and had heard something on the radio just as I was getting out of my car, as it initially started, about a plane hitting one of the World Trade, hitting the World Trade Center. By the time I got to my graduate office, people were in the lounge watching it on TV. And as the day unfolded, we continued to watch it. The class was optional, but it was, mm-hmm. You're in graduate school for political science, taking classes on, American government. We went to class, and then the day got more interesting because then, President Bush at the time flew to Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha. And so everybody, we're in Lincoln, 45 minutes away. Just a very surreal day, but as you said, I can remember it clear as day.
Yeah. And Donna, a remembrance quickly from you.
I was in my first year at the University of Northern Iowa. I was teaching an 8 o'clock class. And at the end of that class, a student said, "Hey, did you hear a plane hit at one of the World Trade Centers?" Which I kind of dismissed because a few years before, a small plane had hit one of the World Trade Centers. And then I taught a second class at 9. And by the end of that, by the time I got back to my office, it was pretty clear that this was not, an error in that sense. And it was here I am in a new job, in a new state. And now we're in a new political environment. And so it was quite interesting, quite jarring.
A solemn day we'll remember on Saturday, the 20th anniversary of the attacks on 9/11, how that has changed our lives, our world, our society, our politics. Donna Hoffman, Chris Larimer, both professors of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna and Chris, thank you so much for your analysis this hour.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
River to River today, produced by Rick Brewer. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.